Hi, welcome back. It's been a while, but it's time for another episode of Play Board Games Better. Finally, I'm going to start the series of episodes on playing Puerto Rico. This is part one, looking at the game with new eyes. Puerto Rico is one of the most highly rated games on Board Game Geek, and one of the most exciting events and tournaments I've attended. For a game with no direct player interaction, the other players are still constantly messing with your perfect plan. To play Puerto Rico at a competitive level, you need to understand the game in detail. This first episode, dedicated to Puerto Rico, will concentrate on presenting the details that aren't in the rules, but are needed to make strategic and tactical decisions. There is one overarching strategy to Puerto Rico, and it is a little different than most games. Get a lead in victory points, and then end the game while you are still ahead. It is this second part, in my opinion, that makes the game exciting and interesting. In many games, the end comes about either after a specific number of turns or randomly, but in Puerto Rico, there are one of three conditions that trigger the end, and you should plan for them, and ideally control at least one of them, and not lose sight of the other two. To achieve the nebulous strategy above, there are two accepted paths. Score the most victory points for shipping goods. Score the most victory points for your buildings and building bonuses. Excellent, experienced players can be opportunistic about choosing between or balancing these strategies. Based on the flow of the game, I think they delay final commitment to a strategy or can play the game tactically all the way to the end. If you are less experienced, and that includes almost everybody, you should pick one of these paths early in the game, maybe even when you see which seat you have. If the choices you make each turn are in tune with the strategy you picked, or block other players from being more successful with a strategy than you are, you have your best chance to play well and score well. Until you really have a feel for the game, it can be overwhelming to try to recalibrate from scratch every turn. Alex Bove told me he thinks it takes a few years of playing to really get a feel for the game. I agree. It's not just playing a lot of games, but letting your mind grow around the game's intricacies that improves your play. As we look at details of the game, keep these two paths in mind. They determine the relative value of every aspect of the game. Given its importance, how many turns are there in a game of Puerto Rico? The minimum possible would be based on building out the town. Theoretically, you could fill up a player board with as few as 8 buildings built in 8 turns. I don't think this is really possible, but 2 large and 8 small buildings in as little as 10 turns is just possible. 12 or to 13 turns with an intense building strategy is certainly doable. A shipping strategy will take a little longer to run out the victory point chips, and it might take so long that the colonists run out first. So I asked experts in the field. John Weber has been running the Puerto Rico tournament at the World Board Gaming Championship since it began. He also keeps an eye on the tournament at EuroQuest. John has only kept track of final games at WBC at the level of detail we're considering. He gives a range of 13 to 17 turns, with 15 being average. Later, we'll look at more of the outstanding work John has done to support and inform play of this game. So you will get to choose your privilege about 15 times and only be the governor with first choice 3 or 4 times. You will make from 42 to as high as 65 actual moves in a single game, but often not to your best advantage. Actually, you'll get about 12 less, as folks take prospector or select roles that you have nothing for. You might have to skip a build, might not have anything to ship, you might be locked out of trading. This leads to an operational theme that you should watch as I discuss the game and as you play. Limit the disadvantage when other folks pick roles that don't benefit your strategy. I learned this from playing Puerto Rico's kid brother, San Juan. In that game, it is important to make sure as few roles as possible are much better for other players. You will make choices and build buildings that make other players' strategies also benefit you. Having some balance in your strategy will, based on my experience, increase your chances of winning. It is very hard to just excel in one part of the game, but totally ignore the rest and win. This is not the same as having a mixed strategy or no plan at all, but you will find decisions you have to make where no choice directly advances your plan. To get anything done in Puerto Rico, you have to chain together a series of moves. There aren't any single plays that score points, only the culmination of a series of moves. These can be broken down into smaller pieces, and that's how I will describe them and how you should think of them. You don't plan 25 moves in your head, well, I don't, as 25 discrete steps. Instead, there are a series of tasks, some of which will be interrupted by others, you want to start and then finish. I think skillful play is based on how many of these you can have going at once without losing track. Efficient play is getting the tasks done quickly before you forget or someone interferes. The basic scoring tasks are build a building, ship your goods. There are only three ways to score points. One is each building you build will score points. Even the bonus buildings are worth 4 points without scoring any bonus at the end of the game. The second is when you ship a good. You'll get at least 1 point per good, and maybe some bonus points too. The third is for bonus points based on the large buildings that you have built and manned, and the manning can be a tricky point, especially at the end of the game. Building a building is not just executing a builder move, it is having the money or quarries and executing the build before someone else gets the building you want. Except for sugar and indigo plants, there are only two or three of each building, and the buildings you want are almost certainly on other players' buy lists. Everyone is lusting after every loose coin and counting how many you have. It's a game of unbridled greed. Money comes into the game six ways. Everyone starts with enough money to buy a small building or two if they are frugal, 3 coins in a 4-player game. Quarries, place one, man it, takes 2 moves, are virtual money. Trading a good gets money, maybe even a lot of money. You have to produce a good, sell it before it rots, ships, or someone else sells that good to the market. Unselected rolls accumulate coins, but not usually for long. And the prospector gets a coin. The factory gets coins when you craft. That's it for money sources, and you don't want to be left out, because even if you didn't care about the victory points for buildings, you're only going to be making and shipping corn until you build some production buildings, so you are definitely in it for the money. The best money deal in the whole game is your first quarry. You don't have to invest money in it, unlike markets and the factory. That is why the first player often selects settler and takes a quarry. Once you get it manned, you will save a coin on every building for the rest of the game. With an aggressive build strategy, that could easily be 9 coins. That's a lot. A second quarry could be worth up to 7, and a third probably only 4 or 5. But denying quarries to the other players may make a third or even fourth one worthwhile. This is not to say you need quarries, but they are a big help with a building strategy and a significant help with any strategy. The prospector is often taken for the money, especially if coins pile up on it. But that isn't the only reason. It's often not clear that any available role is going to be to your advantage at a particular moment. Taking the prospector means you didn't give someone else an advantage. Even if they get to choose an advantageous role, they at least have to use their choice to get it. You should always ask yourself, why shouldn't I take prospector now? It is seldom a mistake to take prospector, but it never directly advances your strategy. Picking a role for the money alone is not a good idea, but money accumulated on a role may make any advantage other players get from it less painful for you. It is also possible that you will realize another player will take it, getting both an advantage and the money, and that you are better off at least making it less of an advantage for someone else. Coins on rolls are serious temptation, and sometimes you should give in to temptation in this game. You will also see roles like captain taken just for the money when no one has anything to ship for the secondary reason that leaving the coins on it will make it too valuable in the future. I like the factory, especially when I have a build strategy going. I'll be rewarded for all the production buildings that I bought in anticipation of the guild hall, or to use with the plantations I got in anticipation of the residence. But the factory isn't cheap, and for a few more coins, I could have bought a harbor or wharf. If I don't plan on getting at least 3 coins on every craftsman roll, I shouldn't buy it. Although taking the last one as a defensive move is often done, it's an expensive way to put a stick in someone else's bicycle wheel. And if you were counting on a factory and didn't get one, try to grab a harbor or wharf and console yourself with the extra victory points for the shipping you do get to do, and with the thought that you have annoyed someone working on a shipping strategy. I've even taken the factory a little out of turn, but I don't want to get too far off track, as we'll go over each building in a later podcast. The last money item is trading. It's very painful to be left out of trading, and it's very difficult to work it smoothly, especially in a four-player game. You can't rely on trades being available when you want them. Even when you would want to choose the role, you can find that the market already has the goods you want to sell, or that another player will make more than you if you select trader. Still, you want that money. When you pick what good to rot, plantation to select, or building to buy, you always have to ask yourself, how does this affect my trade capabilities? The most important aspect is, what does the player on my right want to trade? You don't want to be relying on that good. It will seldom work. Then the player to their right has the next best chance of blocking you. The player to your left is less of a concern, but will have an eye on you. Having a unique item is great, but difficult and temporary. So how much money do you need to generate in a game? With a builder strategy, it's 20 for 2 large buildings, 13 to 16 for 2 3-point buildings, about 14 for 3 2-point buildings, and about 6 for 3 1-point buildings. That's about 55 coins. You start with 3, and you'll probably select builder 5 or 6 times, maybe even with a coin on it once or twice. So you need to generate another 45 coins. You can see why a single quarry would be a big help. Even a factory won't be enough, and you will have to trade a few times. And those coins piling up on rolls are looking larger all the time. With a shipping strategy, you need fewer buildings and less money. You may build as few as 7 buildings and none of the bonus buildings. On the lean side, that is 2 or 3 1-point buildings for 5 or so coins, 2 or 3 2-point buildings for 13 or so coins, 2 or 3 3-point buildings for 15 at least. That's only 33 coins, but you'll be picking builder less often and may not rush to get a quarry as you want productive plantations. You will want to trade even more because it will be your most reliable source of funds. In order to ship a lot, you will produce more than one thing, so being blocked out of trading is a little less likely. Still, having more money and building unneeded buildings adds to your victory point total. And you will want a warehouse to protect your goods, and a wharf, etc. When it comes to the bonus buildings, there are 2 ideas to keep in mind. Which building will score me the most points? Which building should I select to deny an opponent a huge pile of points? The second point is the more sophisticated. You need to see if an opponent can afford the building you think they desire. You need to calculate the point differential for both of you based on the buildings you are considering. And you need to decide if you care about that particular player getting their best building. If you think they are not in the running to beat you, go for maximum points for you, especially as you will probably only get one chance to buy your best bonus building. Someone else will undoubtedly want it after considering the points above from their own perspective. The shipping strategy. I have to admit that I'm not very good with the shipping strategy. I haven't won many games with it, but I've watched good players do it. In some ways, it's both easier and harder than the building strategy. Easier in that you just acquire production with plantations and buildings and cap them away. Harder in that you have to do the craft, trade, ship, dance without tripping yourself. It's better for you if someone else picks craftsmen, but that is true for everyone almost all the time. Eventually, it's a matter of who blinks first or is mesmerized by the coins building up for crafting. And you are thinking, I hope it's the player to my right. You have to care about trading because you spent all your coins on production buildings, but you really want a wharf and harbor, although ore is a more realistic aspiration. The biggest source of whining about Puerto Rico is that an inexperienced player may craft at a bad time and give some other player an unearned advantage. The fact is that a bad choice in crafting can cause serious, unintended consequences. So can any move, but the thrashing about following crafting is the most obvious disruption to anyone's plans for a smooth game. My advice, prepare appropriately when playing with new players. Maybe you should craft more readily than you usually would, just to have more control over the situation. Advice that I have heard from unnamed sources is that you shouldn't craft more than once in a game. When I've looked at games played by expert players, I find that's actually a pretty good guideline. In a game we will look at in detail, the winner never crafted. The second place finisher crafted the most. The 2011 World Board Gaming Champion only crafted once, and the 2010 WBC Champ never crafted, although in that game too, the second place finisher crafted the most. For beginners, and you should emphasize this when teaching the game, crafting is the most dangerous move. The real advice is that you should always ask yourself, is this really the right time to craft? The follow-up question is, then who will captain and who will trade after I do? You should be able to answer that before you craft. Crafting will in many ways seize control of the game for the next few plays, but you have to be satisfied with the outcome that you force on the other players. Yes, it will be considered your fault because you crafted. To mitigate the side effects of crafting, a player working on the shipping strategy wants to have buildings in place. Markets or office for trading, harbor or wharf for captaining, a warehouse to preserve unshippable goods. I'll talk about markets and the office in a bit. But for trading, a harbor or wharf is great. But which is better? It might not be an issue. Money or availability may dictate your choice, and either is good. The wharf, however, has two advantages. One, you cannot be manipulated out of shipping one of your goods. Two, the good is immediately available for crafting, unlike the regular ships, which must be filled before the goods recycle. This can be important if you are making a significant amount of a good, especially late in a game. Just plan accordingly. The harbor pays off with every shipping action, and if you have several types of goods and are not subject to being locked out, often the victory points can pile up nicely. Harbor or wharf can make up for not being able to choose captain, maybe because you crafted, and is a vital part of winning with shipping. The buildings related to trade, markets, and the office can be important. Small market is a very popular first building. It will probably earn 4 to 7 coins over the course of the game. If you can add a large market or an office, the other players will be hesitant to trade due to the large advantage you will have. But large market and office are not the most popular buildings. I've been in more than one game where the office never got used. This is mostly because it was bought by someone who kept getting locked out of the market because market manipulation was an important part of another player's strategy. Because it was so important, that player then expanded their market strategy to include locking the office player out, which turns out not to be as hard as you might expect, because the other players will cooperate by taking any spaces left for them. To close out this episode, I must talk about controlling the end of the game. For building strategy, taking large buildings fills up space and drives the game faster. The large buildings do get 4 victory points each, even without any bonus points, but that is only 2 victory points per space. Having 2 bonus buildings is the fastest way to end a game, as only 10 build actions are needed to force the end. Even so, there is a good chance that the colonists will run out during the same rounds. Lots of building in a game will usually result in large boatloads of colonists to fill the empty city spaces created. You can try to control the end of the game through manipulation of empty spaces on your buildings, but this is hard to do except as a cooperative effort against a player who has developed an enviable shipping system that they are just starting to exploit. The other players would be well advised to minimize the advantage the king or queen of shipping is about to accrue. It might make the outcome more of a toss-up, but the other players only have one shot to stage a revolt. If the game ends because the victory point chips run out, it has become a race among shipping magnates. There is an excellent chance that everyone knows who the winner is before the points are counted. Well, I'm here with Andy Lotto, finally interviewing the person that I play with the most, who's actually the best gamer I play with the most. Not to take anything away from Rich or Rob, they're both excellent gamers, but frankly, Andy wins more games than the rest of them. In fact, Andy, you were the console at the World Board Gaming Championships, which meant that you won more than anybody else.
In that one year, yeah.
In that one year.
I had a lucky year.
All right, Andy might be embarrassed if I say it, but I think he's the best gamer that I play with regularly, and probably one of the best board gamers available right now. That's just my opinion. So, Andy,
you're probably exaggerating some, but I do have a pretty good record.
Yes, you do. Probably the most telling thing was Rob and I are teaching Andy how to play Endeavor, and he's beating us. So that's the way that goes. So, Andy, how did you get interested in gaming?
I cannot remember a time that I was not interested in gaming. I remember playing board games all the time when I was a kid. The first sort of modern-style board game I played was Acquire, which I got for my 12th birthday. So I've been playing this style of game for a long time.
That is a long time. Yeah, my memory doesn't go back much earlier than that, but back in the day, it was Risk, and then Avalon Hills Waterloo that my grandmother gave me. So I did mostly war games for a long time, but it sounds like you started right into traditional board gaming, non-war gaming board gaming.
Right. I looked at a few war games a long time ago, but never really got into them. Card-driven war games are the only thing that have got me interested in war games.
And those are fairly recent.
Yeah.
When was the first competitive event that you went to?
Well, let's see. If you count card as well as board games, I'm a bridge player. I've been playing bridge since I was 12. Playing in bridge tournaments. Where I don't do nearly as well as I do in board games.
No?
No.
That you have national rating and...
No, I'm an intermediate level bridge player.
Okay. I didn't get into it too big. Actually, my mother-in-law was rated for a while, and my brother-in-law was quite good when he played actively. Never got into it myself. WBC seems to be one of your favorite events.
Oh, yeah.
And you go there and you
have a terrific time.
Yes, it is a lot of fun, even for people like me who don't win very much. It's still a great time to play, because you get to play with some really good players. And frankly, as good as they are, they're just as nice. You're fun to play with. You never gloat.
Glad to hear you think that. I care much more about people thinking I'm a nice player, a nice person to play games with, and that I win a lot.
Well, and I learn a lot playing with you. That's important for me. You know, one of the things I like to do. One of the things the podcast about is helping people try to play better. I personally feel, of course, that I'd rather lose in a game where everybody's playing decently than win in a game where most people are not doing well, floundering around, or not focused on the game. That's just me, but that's sort of what the podcast is about. What's your favorite game, right now?
My favorite game is probably Hannibal. It's funny, mostly I don't like war games that much, but a few of them I like a lot. Hannibal, Here I Stand, Labyrinth. I don't know whether Labyrinth I'll like in the future. It's very new, but right now it looks like it's on the road to becoming a favorite.
Andy just taught it to me today, and it's a game that requires some serious learning. It's got a combination of war game mechanics and other game mechanics and card management.
It feels like it has a lot of luck, and there are wild swings, but if there were one or two die rolls that were all that mattered, then it would be a game of luck. But it feels like there's 50 die rolls that are all the crucial die rolls that make the difference, and
right.
That's enough for the luck to even out.
Yeah, it's true. A lot of the things you attempt have less than 50% probability, so you have to keep trying them.
Yep.
Because you have to accomplish them, which is different. That's very different in a game.
And the games I do well at seems to often be the games that other people say, oh, that one is just luck.
I think that's true. Turn of Taxis is probably, in my experience with playing with you, one of the games that's like that. I think a lot of people think that it's very heavily influenced by luck, but you have so many opportunities to control the outcome that it's not completely true.
Yeah.
I'll have to admit, though, one of my lifetime achievements was actually beating Andy in a game of Turn of Taxis once. But I did get a lot of help by being the player before Andy in all the game, and the player before me made a couple of moves that were basically bad for both of us, but fortunately I got to recover first.
Yep.
Which was the key to that one. So that's the rule. Always play before Andy in a game if you get a chance. Just remember that one. What's your favorite competitive event for the tournaments you've been in to date? And you've been in a lot.
Let's see. Certainly one of the favorite experiences, even though it wasn't playing the Ingenious tournament when it was the one that let me win four tournaments in one WBC, tying the record. and that was exciting. And it was not easy competition. I was playing against Bruce Reif and Pete Stein, and I can't remember who the fourth person is, but he was a good player too. So I don't know how I pulled that one out. It's not a game I think of what I'm strong at. Event I probably enjoy most, time in and time out again, is probably Hannibal, just because it's a game that takes 3 hours or more to play, and I like it enough that I can sit down for a weekend and play it 5 times, and every game will be different, and every game will have tough decisions to make.
That's true. So the Hannibal event, is that in the separate...
It's a pre-con. It's Saturday pre-con, and Sunday.
So before the other events start up, so it doesn't interfere with your vast, fairly busy schedule of tournaments for WBC.
The schedule is infinitely busy. There's pretty much always two events I want to be playing at any given time, because I like a lot of games.
And that's the way it feels for me. There's always, two things I'm thinking, which one do I want to go to?
Last year in the Hannibal tournament, you played 3 games the first day, 2 games the second day. Then I was wandering out into open gaming, and someone saw me carrying Hannibal and said, I've always wanted to learn that. And I sat down and taught him, and we played my 6th game of Hannibal for the weekend. That was a little overkill even for me.
Yeah, that's a lot of one game. And then, especially when you get another week of gaming coming up right afterwards.
That's a game I don't think I'm good at yet. The 1 year I did get lucky and win 4 out of 5.
The combat system in Hannibal is probably one of the things I'm the worst at. I consistently lose card management in that particular combat system. And that's one where you have the different formation cards that you play against each other.
Yeah.
I've played it in several types of games because they used
We the People.
We the People, right.
Is there any other games?
I honestly don't think so. Even in the redo of We the People, they took it out.
It's a polarizing mechanic. A lot of people seem to hate it, and I really like it.
I could see the appeal, but I'm consistently terrible at it. Somebody who's good at it is Joel.
I sort of feel that winning it is not a lot of skill. Winning it, mostly just playing your longest suit and hoping. What the interesting thing about it for me is not that you have the tactical decision of do I want to keep fighting this battle or do I want to withdraw? Or is the important thing to have a lot of attrition or a little bit of attrition? And do I want to try to just try to win or do I want to take risks to win with a double envelopment? And so it's the fact that it isn't just a game you win or lose, but a game with different alternatives. And the tactics have to be determined by the strategy of the whole game, of the game as a whole, and what your objective is. That's the interesting thing about it. If you're losing all your tactical battles, that's probably just that you're getting into the wrong tactical battles in terms of how many cards you have and how powerful your generals are.
I'm suitably admonished. That's probably true. So I need better strategy. Then I'll get better tactics. Not the other way around, surprisingly. Probably why you like the game. Now, what's your favorite tournament format? There's really, there's a few.
I haven't thought about that much. I guess it depends on the circumstance. That is, at WBC, because there are so many different games I like to play, I like short formats, even though they're not nearly as much of a test of skill. But, if you play it and play until you lose one and then go on and play some other game. But if I was just setting up a tournament, if I just said, this weekend, I want us all to get together and play a Labyrinth tournament, then I'd probably want a Swiss tournament because that lets everybody play more.
That's true. There's a lot more playing, but it takes up a bigger chunk of time when you're in a multi-tournament format like that. I've asked this question and not getting too many answers. If you could change something in the way most of the tournaments are run, is there anything you would change or improvement that you think?
You mean at WBC?
Well, yes.
Or EuroQuest? Mostly they're very well run. Don made a really good decision when he said, I'm not going to pay the GMs, because I think you get a much higher quality of GMing there than in things where people are partly motivated to GM by saying, I'll get a free entry into the con or a free room or something like that. And you get the people who love the game. I guess the other key decision is you are allowed to play in the tournaments you run, because otherwise the people who really love the game will say, I'll let someone else run it so I can play.
That's true. Actually, I was very surprised when I brought that up with Tom Vassell and it started the discussion online. A lot of people were somewhat amazed that someone could be running the tournament and actually be in the tournament, that somehow that people would consider that improper behavior, that there was some kind of risk of shenanigans if that was allowed. And I was surprised at their surprise.
Mostly these games regulate themselves. It's pretty rare for anyone to even have to get any ruling from the GM or have the GM have any involvement in the games. And to deal with that rare situation, Don has a rule, is you name 2 assistant GMs before you start, and if you're involved in a game where a ruling is needed, you let the assistant GMs make the ruling. And that's never happened to me in the Third and Texas tournaments. I did play Stuart Tucker, who runs the Hannibal tournament. I played him in the tournament, and actually we had a rules disagreement. He went to the assistant GMs, and they ended up deciding it in my favor. So I don't feel...
I agree that it's not a problem. In the last EuroQuest, one of the two GMs, Barb Lexington, ended up in the finals, and the other GM...
Is this Puerto Rico?
Yes, and the other GM was her husband. Right. So as the assistant GM, I actually ran the final game.
Because you didn't make it to the finals that time?
Yes. And in fact, it became late at night and everybody was sleepy. I didn't just run it, I croupiered it. No one touched anything while it was going on except me, for fear that they would mess up the game and have to start over again at like 12:30.
When I played the Isfahan finals last year at WBC, after the second one of us made the mistake of taking their play and then grabbing all the dice and just, you know, because you're used to games where you roll the die, you play, and you pick up the dice. Here you pick up some of the dice and leave the rest in Isfahan. And two of us started to make the mistake of destroying the position by grabbing the dice, at which point the GM said, okay, none of you are touching the dice. You tell me what to do, I will manipulate the dice for the rest of the game.
I'm going to actually be running the Isfahan tournament at WBC this year, so I guess I'll be watching for that. Thanks for the warning.
Okay.
And there's...
I'll be defending my championship.
Yes, you will. That's right. And actually, the most likely person to be the person for the champion the year before is Kelly.
Yes, I'll be defending my championship against my sweetie.
Yes, exactly. That. Yeah. If there's a rule of disagreement there, I want to leave the room. But you know, I'll be stuck.
We played the finals 1 year of Lost Cities against each other.
Oh, okay. And that turned out okay?
But yes.
It was only Lost Cities. This is Isfahan. There's camels involved.
I see.
People could get tense.
I think that having the GMs run the tournament really worked fine, because there's nothing more at stake than the honor of it. And what would be the honor of it if
there's
you didn't...
a plaque.
Yeah. A piece of wood. Wow. You can go outside and there's pieces of wood on those trees. And so what would be the point of it if you knew that you didn't get it deservedly? Now, if we were talking about the Magic World Championship where there's $10,000 at stake, or a poker tournament, the people who run the World Series of Poker are not playing in the tournament when they're making rulings.
That's right. And in Magic, you know, GMing is actually harder in Magic. There's so many cards involved. It's not just one game that you have to know. You have to know a very large body of knowledge, which they are certified in.
Yeah, the rules.
The testing is pretty rigid, and depending on the size of the tournament, there are grades of judges.
I found a sample test online once. I couldn't find it again, but I just enjoy understanding complicated rules, and the full rules of Magic are like a 50-page thing.
Right,
and
yes.
Having this quiz of, here are tricky cases where you have to be very careful as to how to apply them. I like puzzles. It was a great puzzle.
Yes. Fortunately, we don't have to do that just to enjoy some competitive play of these games.
Right. These are the simple rules, complicated consequences games.
The other question, because the podcast is actually about helping other people play better, is when you're playing other people, what do you think is the not most common mistake, the most common thing they don't understand that would improve their gameplay?
Well, let's see. It depends on the game. You know, some games where the problem is not focusing on the victory condition, but you're accomplishing something that was a means to an end and forgetting about the end. That's why I lost the game of, how do you pronounce that, Troyes?
Troyes, right.
That's how I lost the game of Troyes we played yesterday. There were so many different pieces to getting an engine going that it was only more than halfway through the game before I said, oh yeah, victory points. It would be nice to get some victory points.
There are a number of games where I think that's tricky, where for me I have to play it a few times before I get to the point where I can put together pieces of the mechanics to actually have some effect on what I score.
There are a lot of games that have a transition to make, like St. Petersburg is sort of, that's what the whole game is about, is early in the game trying to do something else, namely get money, and later in the game trying to get the victory points to win the game, and figuring out how to make that transition. I'll answer a slightly different question than the one you asked, which is, what do people do wrong in terms of improving at a game? Which is, I think that people often, if they care about a game, think really, really hard and play really, really slowly to try to analyze it as completely as they can. And I think you do better by playing more games in the same amount of time and getting more experience. And that's why a lot of games, the best players are the online players, because the game goes so much faster. There's a Go proverb that to get to Shodan, which is the equivalent of Black Belt, takes 1,000 games. And so what that really means is it doesn't matter how well you play those games or how hard you're thinking about them, it matters that you have to play 1,000 of them. And so play fast and you get your 1,000 games in quicker.
I That's true. I think that the time to put in the thinkiness is take some time to look at a game, the rules, fool around with the mechanics before you're actually playing, so you see how some of the pieces fit together. And then play.
Right.
Right.
And afterwards, sometimes there's some games where you can try to think about, well, what happened? You know, this is why I can't wrap my head around the 1830 games, is that 18XX games. I lose the game, and you know, I make a lot of difficult decisions, and I lose, and I said, by a lot. So one of those decisions I made was way, way wrong, but I don't have the understanding to figure out which one it was, and so it's hard to learn anything.
That's true. That is tough. Those are particularly tough games. I think they appeal to different kinds of players. Does it really matter, competitive play versus non-competitive play, or you just like both kinds a lot? I mean, you spend a lot of time playing.
Yeah.
But you do some other competitive things. You're wearing your ParadisePoker.com t-shirt.
Online poker is not something that exists anymore, basically. The big sites just got closed down a few weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
And I did not do well playing online, but I did quite well playing in person. Continue to do that. You know, when I'm playing poker, I care about winning. And really, I think the answer to your question depends upon the game. Right? Poker played with bad players is easy to win and is boring. It's not an interesting game. Because the strategy to play against bad players is you sit there and you fold and you wait for a good hand, and then you bet and they will call you and you win. The game gets interesting only because people are trying to deceive you, and you're trying to figure out what you're doing despite that. They may be representing one hand, but they're aware that they have to camouflage this and sometimes have a different hand than the one they're representing. And so you're thinking, is it, if I think that he thinks that I think that he thinks, is the whole interesting part of it. And there are other games that I find fun with strong or weak players. There's a lot of Euro games, you know, if there's four of us playing and we're equally matched, then if I think as hard as I can, I'll win 25% of the time. And if I don't, I'll win less. And if I'm playing against weak players, then it might mean that play seat of my pants without thinking about anything, I'll win 35% of the time, and if I think hard, I can win 45% of the time. So, you know, good play is still rewarded, and the skills are still the same.
Is there any other message you'd like to give to other gamers who'd like to become as good as you?
I'd say just don't play to try to win and play for the fun of it. And, you know, which is not to say that if trying hard to make your best plays and win makes it fun, then that's what you should do.
Well, thanks, Andy.
Thank you.
In the next installment on Puerto Rico, we'll go over the 2010 EuroQuest final game. I'll include pictures of every move to make it possible to follow the game easily. Then we'll have a discussion of individual buildings and the different goods. I hope to include interviews with Puerto Rico players, and maybe I can get Mr. Weber to join us. Before then, I'm planning to issue a report on the final game of Isfahan at the 2011 World Board Gaming Championships. I ran that tournament, and the final was an exciting face-off between three of the toughest gamers I know. If you think of Isfahan as a light, friendly, family game, you need to watch how it can be turned into a heavyweight free-for-all. Thanks for listening.